You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 24th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, John Hale, author of The Choice We Face, The Origins of School Choice, and the Demise of Public Education. Meanwhile, divisions between House Democrats deepen in the infrastructure fight as a group of centrist Democrats threaten to blow the whole thing up. Yesterday's budget process ended without resolution. More on that in a bit. After the FDA granted Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine full approval, the military, the NYC school system, and more have announced vaccine mandates, and more will follow as Biden publicly urges more employers and businesses to require the shots. The era of Andrew Cuomo has officially ended. The embattled former governor, feels good to say, resigned yesterday, commuting some sentences on his way out, and Kathy Hochul was sworn in at midnight. She is the first female governor of New York State. In Afghanistan, the Taliban announced that they will no longer allow Afghans to go to the airport to evacuate the country, as U.S. troops are set up to assist with evacuation efforts, so could be a clash there. Extreme heat is hitting a huge swath of this country, causing drought in the Dakotas, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and more, causing near record lows in soil moisture. And lastly, in Haiti, the earthquake's death toll has passed 2,200, with tens of thousands left homeless and children without food or medical care. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out this week. I will be with you today. As a reminder, if you're just tuning in now, we have a great show for you. I'm excited to talk to John Hale a bit about the concept of school choice because, you know, for some reason, education policy doesn't get the attention it probably should in this country. And I think a lot of that stems from this inherent desire by parents to personalize and individualize their own child's education and how much that's been a part of the way we view education, but a lot of that's by design. And the collective nature of it is sapped by these school choice initiatives. And so I'm excited to talk a bit more about that. But before we get into that, let's talk about this infrastructure fight and this gang of center-right Democrats who are holding it up. Representative Josh Gottheimer is leading this gang of right-wing Democrats. They call themselves
the Gang of Squares.
Yeah, the Gang of Nerds. They call themselves the Mod Squad. I'm not kidding. And it's really an attempt to tank Joe Biden's agenda. Imagine for a second if progressives were the ones doing this, what the kind of uproar would be. Basically, what it boils down to is that Gottheimer and this other group, or eight other centrists, they want to pass just the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the one that passed the Senate, without the Democrats-only reconciliation package, the one that includes all the stuff that Democrats want to prioritize, child care, child tax credit extension, climate provisions, the expansion of Medicare to include dental, hearing and vision. And this was agreed upon by Democratic leadership in the pursuit of this legislation. So, like, it was always going to be a dual track, and they were always going to be tied together. And this has been known for months and months and months. And this was a way to get progressives on board, too, because AOC and Jamal Bowman in the House, for example, Sanders in the Senate, who was instrumental in creating the framework for this legislation, like, they were not going to vote for just the bipartisan reconciliation bill. And so this was a mutually assured destruction situation. Now, Democratic leadership and the White House, they were all on board and still are on board for this dual track strategy that they'll be passed together. Again, this was known all along. They'll pass together or not at all. And yet Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, who represents a very wealthy suburb of the city, Tom Suozzi is another person on board with this, represents a wealthy suburb of the city as well in New York, on Long Island. Their pet project is this SALT deduction, which we'll get into in a second. But they're basically making a demand that this SALT deduction, which helps wealthy suburbs of the city and wealthy people in it, that that needs to be addressed. And they're holding the entire reconciliation package hostage for this purpose.
It's called a deduction. It's a tax cut.
It's a tax cut, right. But, you know, we've got to frame it in certain ways to protect certain people. So, Pelosi and Democratic leadership are actually understandably quite frustrated by this. There's a bit of a stalemate between the Gottheimer gang and Democratic leadership, because this is what we've known for many, many months was going to be the path forward. It's odd to say Pelosi's on the right side of something, but she is in this instance. The standoff continues to be going on through today, because the negotiations on the budget framework for the reconciliation package went deep into the night, and Gottheimer did not budge. So this is a very long prelude to show you this clip of Gottheimer on CNBC being asked about his decision to hold up this entire process for maintaining a tax benefit for rich people in blue states.
What does the final SALT compromise look like for you and your colleagues, Suozzi, and the other guys that think it's really important to change that? Would you accept a higher cap? Is that what it's going to be? Do you think?
You know, my position on that remains unchanged. We've talked about here before. Full reinstatement of the state level tax deduction. There's no reason why we should be paying taxes twice. And this is a middle class issue here in northern New Jersey. Nope. And when we've talked about in Bergen County, the median property tax is over $15,000. So, you know, people's taxes went up in 2017 when they gutted SALT. Now it's time to reinstate it and get people actually tax relief back here and get them tax cuts back here.
Tax relief.
You're talking about, you know, a teacher and a firefighter who really will get relief when this gets done. A third of New Jersey will benefit from it. So that's my fight on that, on the reconciliation package. And we're going to focus on it, and we'll get that done too.
Well, you all constantly say you don't like higher taxes in general on anything. And that whole $3.5 trillion boondoggle, you're going to be voting for, you know, taxes out the wazoo, Josh. And I just don't see how
we haven't actually seen. Let's look at the total impact on. I'm going to focus on one thing, the total impact on my district.
On Kelly.
I'm making sure that Kelly is okay.
Yeah, no, there's some.
We'll look at that. We've got to look at that when the legislation's written. There's no bill yet.
You what?
So when the bill is written, we'll look at it.
I got to draw you out.
SALT is a problem. You can't be for SALT, but, you know, you're helping the wealthy. I'm sorry. There are a few teachers in town. They're married to people on Wall Street for the most part. I don't think it's helping a lot in the middle class.
Well, I'll introduce you to a lot of folks that I'm hearing from who are real middle class folks.
Josh loves coming on and faces that, and we love having you, Josh. Thank
Oh, well, he was not expecting that kind of response.
Not on that channel.
There, yeah, right on CNBC. That's Kelly Evans, who basically just called him on his BS there with the framing. So he says this is a middle-class issue. Brookings Institute, the Tax Policy Center, which is respected, found that 20% of U.S. households receive the top 20%, I should say, receive 96% of the benefits from a unfettered SALT deduction. And it's really top-heavy within that as well. The top 1% receive over 50% of the benefits from a full, unlimited SALT deduction. So, like, he says, I'm just going to focus on one thing in that interview, and that's pretty much accurate. This guy, along with other members of this centrist bloc, are holding up the entire Biden infrastructure agenda, which, you know, Not just the hard infrastructure, right? The bipartisan bill that won't, like, progressives have already said, and they have enough votes, they're not going to advance that unless the reconciliation bill is advanced. And then the flip side is happening with Gottheimer and this entire crew. Like, they are holding up that entire agenda for a tax cut for the wealthy, and that's how it needs to be framed. And it's also, as you say, as the anchor said, it's bad messaging just for purely the Democratic Party's electoral decisions. They're becoming a party that's catering more towards this specific suburban donor class. So that's part of maybe why, you know, you have more people signing on with this approach by Gottheimer than I think there should be. But it allows for, I saw an article of Chuck Grassley going after Democrats for supporting tax cuts for the rich with the SALT deduction, like, incredibly hypocritical of Grassley to claim that, but they get to claim that because this, in this instance, it's the reality. It's the reality.
And I just think that this is on Biden, because what leverage do they really have? They're really going to sink all of this? Okay, do that. And then go try to figure out and try to win another election after doing that. I think the pressure needs, like, this is, they need, they'll need, like, and I think that you're seeing the right signs from the leadership, but ultimately this can't win because they don't have any leverage. This is just purely for corporate and suburban wealthy interests, generally speaking.
And they're, yeah, right. But at the same time, like, there might be some compromise reach where there's a raising of what's allowed, or there's a compromise where they split the baby, which I think Pelosi would be primed to do, and I'm worried about that shoe dropping. There obviously should be zero repeal, but, you know, this could be a way for her to throw chum to this particular crowd, even though they're obsessing over pay-fors.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really care about pay-fors, as people know, but as long as the big bill gets out, that's what I care about. And if these people stand in the way, I think that it's just absurd.
Right. Gottheimer is one. I have a lot of things to say about him, but maybe I'll refrain.
Should hopefully an ex-Democrat at some point.
Right. And we should say that the DCCC is actually, for the first time in my career covering this stuff, is trying to hold these centrists accountable, and is threatening their reelection funds if they continue to go down this path of tanking the Democratic president's agenda. On the flip side, a lot of these representatives in this caucus had leftist primary challenges that Pelosi and leadership helped actively squash, her and Steny Hoyer. And now, look what's happening. Karma, a little bit, but it's not too sweet, because it could really hurt the rest of us. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by John Hale to talk about education.
Thank you, Emma. Folks, you know, I know you're going to think I'm weird this way, but there is one of the best feelings I have. I mean, obviously, I love my kids and stuff like that, but going into the dentist and having them sort of surprised at the level of my personal dental hygiene. And it's not because I walk in there and they're like, oh, you don't look like a guy who has a good dental hygiene, just broadly speaking, from the way you carry yourself. It's just that I do a great job with dental hygiene because I take it seriously. I've dedicated myself a couple years ago. I realized, like, oh, my teeth are going to cost me $1 million if I don't start taking care of them. And I have been. And a big part of that has made it so much easier for me has been Quip. They're a design company that focused on dental hygiene. They've got great toothbrushes. They've got what I think is one of, like, the modern miracles of man in their reusable flosser, which they've never even given me copy to advertise about it. And I think it's the greatest thing ever been invented. They also have, like, that great Pez dispenser for the gum. They have really great products that were just designed to make it easier for you to take care of your teeth well. And now, after 140 years of no changes in mouthwash, Quip has created a mouthwash that is giving you more of the ingredients that you need. And it comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that is 100% recyclable. like I say, you know, Quip, they make this great toothbrush. They make the flossers. They make the gums that helps you with your bad breath and prevents cavities. And now their four times concentrate mouthwash has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the stinging alcohol you find in a lot of the other rinses. And you get a customizable subscription. You can get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch to a complete oral care routine. You pair it with the Quip electric toothbrush for adults, and both my kids have them. The refillable flossers, Quip's great tasting, good for your gum, that can help keep your teeth clean between brushes. Bingo, bango, you can show up at your dentist and get the Sam Cedar treatment. And if you go to getquip.com/majority5, right now you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser, a 90-day dose supply of Quip's four times concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. Majority 5. Spelled getquip.com/majority5. Quip, the good habits company. Emma, back to you.
We are back. And we would like to welcome to the program John Hale, author of The Choice We Face, The Origins of School Choice, and The Demise of Public Education. John, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk about your book because I feel like we're fighting the notion of school choice as this kind of egalitarian notion that plucks the most deserving children out of these awful public school systems on many sides, right? And your book touches on these multiple buckets. You got wealthy conservatives, you've got kind of liberals in cities who feel like they can fix this, and then there's kind of grassroots energy on the ground about some of this, which baffles me to an extent. But, you know, I guess let's just really start at the beginning, the notion of school choice, how this you know, began really with Brown v. Board of Education, if we could start and then move towards the modern day.
Yeah, so, you know, school choice as we know it really begins in the aftermath of the Brown decision, people trying to resist desegregating schools, and, you know, freedom of choice turns into the rhetoric of the right to choose where we go to school, but it becomes a way of talking about going to segregated schools without sounding racist, really. So, and it sort of builds from this racist policy to avoid going to desegregated schools into this form that we see today.
Right. And so I guess let's delineate for people some of the options that school choice allows, or the different sections of education that it divvied things up into. You got charter schools, magnet schools, but there are more options than that. What are they?
Yeah, so, you know, in addition to magnets and charters, one of the more insidious options are vouchers. And we saw these in the 1950s, where you're using government money to fund families directly, and they can choose any school they want, more often than not religious private schools. So vouchers really lead to the privatization of schools. Now, during the pandemic, we see online education really taking off, and even homeschooling is an option of school choice.
Yeah, what Supreme Court decision allowed for, I'm blanking on it at this moment, was there not a Supreme Court decision that was a bit contested about public funds via vouchers going to religious schools?
Yeah, so Zelman v. Harris in 2004 really sort of talk about how, you know, we can use public funding.
Oh, I'm sorry, your audio cut out.
Yeah, we just lost your audio somehow, John. We'll maybe cut to a break real quick and we'll start this audio out.
Oh, wait, oh, we hear you now.
It's just something it wasn't supposed to.
Oh, there we go.
There you go.
Yeah, the Zelman v. Harris decision really allows public funding to go to families. And if they wanted to, they can choose to go to a private school. So with this, we see vouchers have a sort of legitimacy in the courts that it's actually legal to do this on smaller scales. But this is just one other choice option that's become validated by the Supreme Court. So we really see more choice after in the early 2000s.
Yeah, and so there are a variety of different steps. I guess let's go back to Brown v. Board and some of the justifications that were used there. Like, it's so interesting to see it framed as choice and for that framing to remain. Black families didn't have a choice. Like, black families were not a part of the choose whatever school you want to go to so you don't have to integrate your children with other black kids. Like, that was not an option. Talk about that concept and how heavily racialized it really was from the outset.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And from the very beginning, whites and privileged elite white families really used what they called freedom of choice to avoid desegregated schools. And it was designed by and for elite, wealthier white families to say, the government has no right to tell me where to go to school. And if I don't want to go to school, a desegregated school, if I don't want to go to school with black students or students of color, I have a right of freedom of association, was the legal argument, to where I am choosing to spend my time with whom I choose to spend my time with. And upon this principle, they developed this idea of school choice. It's my choice where to go to school. The government cannot tell me where to go to school. And especially for some social experiment like desegregation, that families should have a right to opt out of that. So from the very beginning, it's a way to avoid desegregated schools. It's a way to dictate at your own level where you want to go to school. And from that, it just sort of builds upon that very principle. And to your point, you're exactly right, where people of color, black families, not have that choice. Right, they weren't involved in the process of coming up with freedom of choice that we choose where to go. Black families just wanted to go to a school that they wanted to because they were prevented by law from attending that school. Freedom of choice is something very different that whites are using to avoid desegregation. So from the very start, it's a policy to avoid desegregation, and it's also a rhetorical way to talk about race without having to talk about it, right? So especially during busing in the 1970s, say, I don't want to go to that school because it's my choice not to go. You don't have to say you don't want to go to school with children of color. It's a more convenient way that's palatable across the nation.
Yeah, I'm reminded of other discussions we've had on this show about the notion of taxpayer, right? Which is also heavily racialized. I'm contributing taxes. I own property during this era where property taxes were, the income tax wasn't around. I own property. I'm the one who's should be, and my people like me are the only people who should be having a say in our government, and everyone else should else basically be grateful. These are just notions we repeat today, choice, taxpayer, that have so much baggage and weight behind them. In terms of like the racial resentment caked in to those terms. But, you know, your book talks about Milton Friedman a bit, and it all seems to come back to him in the end, unfortunately for us. He was a huge advocate for this concept back in the day. Talk about his influence over this debate.
Milton Friedman, a lot of people are very upset to this day when you make this association. Milton Friedman was critical in bringing school choice to a national level, because up until this point, you had segregationists in Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, the former Confederacy, using freedom of choice as a way to very blatantly avoid going to desegregated schools. Milton Friedman, as an award-winning economist in the University of Chicago, provides a gravitas, a way to talk about school choice at a different level. And when he starts talking about it, you know, folks in Chicago, New York, Boston, northern cities have new language to use when desegregation comes to their cities. So when Chicago and Boston don't want to desegregate, Milton Friedman's talking about an educational marketplace. He's talking about the right of taxpayers to use their own money in ways that they see fit. So Milton Friedman provides a new language to not sound like Southern segregationists. He provides a new way of talking about it. And he also provides this economic theory, which says, let's put competition into this public school system. Let's provide innovative teaching and innovative schools to improve the whole system. So he's introducing not only a new way of talking about it, but a new theory about how we should run schools. And this is what's really taken off today.
Well, you can see very prominent shades of that in the way that, like, liberals in the North talk about school choice. We saw during the same time, as you write, a mass exodus of white people, particularly affluent white people, from cities to suburbia, which I think also was paired with the notion that public education can be circumvented for my special child. So I guess talk about his influence over that particular regional discourse and a bit of how that still remains today.
Yeah, so Milton Friedman, you know, in Choice itself, allows people to, you know, use a new way of talking about it, where I have a right to go to school wherever I want to go. And it, especially as taxpayers, right, I'm allowed to move to the suburbs now and go to schools and have a stronger say where I want to go. So in many ways, it becomes this sort of worldview that people have about schools. Schools should be run like a business. And as a taxpayer, as a consumer, I have a right to determine what that product should look like. And it's very influential, especially in the North, because in the city of Chicago, for instance, we have massive white flight out of the city. And we have these arguments about taxpayers. Well, I pay taxes and we should have a stronger say in how this works. Right. So it's a very, and it's a different way of talking about it than the Southern segregation approach, which is to put police in front of the doors and not allow Black children into the school. It's an economic argument that people use that benefits supposed taxpayers, which is coded for whiteness, right? If you're a legitimate citizen, if you're paying taxes, that's a way to sort of say that, and to use taxpayers, that phrase itself is a way to talk about it. So it's privileging white wealthy families to determine what our school system looks like at a time when it should become more equitable, because that's what the Brown decision said.
Well, it's also just enthusiastically embracing, like, the purest form of that Friedmanomics neoliberal economic ideology and applying it to these, like, basic social foundational structures that should be completely immune from that kind of thinking. Unfortunately for us, it wasn't that way over the past few decades.
Well, and also the idea that, you know, it's based on this assumption that, you know, when you look at an education marketplace, it's all based on the assumption that these parents or these individuals or consumers, to draw on this language and rhetoric, will act rationally. But as Friedman's writing this in the city of Chicago, he can see white vigilante groups attacking Black families who are moving into white neighborhoods. He can see apartments in Cicero burning. He can see Dr. King talking about Chicago being worse than any place in the South that he's ever visited. People are not acting rationally when they're choosing and selecting schools. So that argument goes out the window when you can just look outside of his office at University of Chicago and see people acting not only irrationally, but violently, to avoid going to desegregated schools. So the whole theory is corrupt from the start, because people will not act rationally when it comes to where they send their kids to school.
John, you sound like you're being very irrational. I'm joking.
Right, yeah. You can see the mail I'm getting, too.
Right, exactly. Hey, I'm familiar with that. So let's just really then talk about the role of both parties in kind of pushing this to the fore. We can start with Reagan, who promulgated a lot of this. Clinton, of course, No Child Left Behind under Bush, Obama's achievement gap stuff, and then, you know, Betsy DeVos being in, you're in the Midwest, right? Like, she's so prominent there. We can take it step by step. Let's start with Reagan. All of these presidents and their parties being very instrumental in pushing this concept to where we are today.
Yeah, so in you're outlining, you know, the sort of trajectory of what this looks like. So let's start with Milton Friedman, right? Milton Friedman becomes an economic advisor to none other than Barry Goldwater, right? You know, Barry Goldwater is basically just articulating what Friedman tells him to in terms of economic policy. So the ideas of an education marketplace and their individual choice, the right of the taxpayer, right, really becomes baked into this new Republican Party that we begin to see in the 1960s. So Nixon can champion these policies when he's elected to president. And Nixon is president when busing is a, you know, constitutional means at the time to achieve a level of desegregation. So now Nixon can talk about taxpayers being opposed to busing or the right of association, the right to choose where to go to school. So it becomes even more popular when the northern cities are faced with desegregation. But, you know, northerners don't necessarily want to sound, again, like a southern segregation. So they don't say, I'm opposed to busing. But what they mean is, I'm opposed to desegregation. I'm right. opposed to sending my kids across the city to go to school. Right. Well, I'm opposed to desegregation. It's a way to talk about it. So it becomes more popular. And then Reagan, probably the pinnacle of the Republican Party in terms of this its transformation, in his 1980 education plan, he wants to privatize the system. He wants to bring vouchers back. And there's now congressional support for it. But it's not just a Republican issue. As we talked about, we on all sides of the political spectrum is supportive of school choice. Because by the 1980s, when white flight has decimated the public school system, people are afraid to go to public schools because the press, a largely white press, has painted schools as these very violent spaces. We also see a school prison nexus in police officers in public schools for the first time. A lot of white people are afraid to go to public schools. So Democrats, especially Southern Democrats, Bill Clinton, right, William Winters, Bill Riley in South Carolina, they're adopting these school choice plans to allow their constituents to go to a public school that makes them feel safe, that makes them feel better, because they grew up in the desegregation era. They saw it and they know what rhetoric is going to work for their base. So all of the, and then some, you know, like Bill Clinton's becoming president, he is the first Democrat to pass federal legislation and federal funding for charter schools. So we can't let Democrats off the hook too, because with Clinton comes in federal support for school funding. And of course, with President Obama, he increases the funding for charter schools. He's supportive of the idea of school choice. His Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, comes from Chicago that has been privatized through charter schools and other schools of choice. So it's part and parcel a bipartisan policy of school choice. And we can't forget that when we're talking about it. There's not one person, one group of people or constituents who are for it. It's across the spectrum.
Well, it's just the branding, right? There's the sanitized Friedmanomics version that the Democratic Party espouses. And then, like, it's still sanitized to a degree on the right, but it's a bit more obvious what they're trying to do, which is kind of pretty part and parcel of the ideologies or the way that, that each party brands themselves. Anyway, but, you know, I'm interested in how this kind of rise of the billionaire philanthropists, like philanthropists, I say in quotes, like Bill Gates, or, you know, the Waltons pouring a bunch of money into education. Like the Gatesian philosophy seems to be very heavily influencing the Democratic side of things. And like, I think we're having a bit of a reckoning about that, how wrong that was, given, for example, what you've seen in Chicago. But it's not enough. Like, the fact that there were mass school closures and Rahm Emanuel left office in disgrace, that should probably show people, or not even in disgrace, I guess he has a cushy job as a commentator now, but with very low approval ratings. Like, that should basically be show this was a failure, but we're still not necessarily there to the degree we should be.
We should be. If we read not only my book, right, here's a self plug for that, but also all the research on school choice that shows that there's a major failure at hand here, and we're not seeing it. It would be easier, I think, for people to see that, not only if they just dug a little bit more instead of just buying into the rhetoric of choice, but the problem is the public schools themselves aren't doing the job. So because if I'm very critical of school choice, obviously, But I'm also willing to recognize that public schools aren't doing what it's supposed to do, because people, the American public, taxpayers, right, have backed away from the notion of a public good through public schools. So through generations of moving away from public schools, of talking about school choice, of insisting on vouchers and privatization, that has weakened a public school system to the extent where it can't meet people's needs. It can't meet their interests and desires. So we're trying to prop up a system that's been defeated and deflated since the Brown decision. So yes, Democrats can point to and say, yeah, this is not working very well. What else can we try? And Americans, we want a quick fix. School choice, a new charter school, a voucher to go to a private school. That's a quick fix. That's a silver bullet that a lot of people want. So no wonder why. Yes, if you do the research, we should be against school choice more. But when you look at what public schools, we've decimated that system. So it's really hard to sort of say, yeah, school choice is wrong, but let's go back to public schools. We're in a really tough bind right now. So, yeah, I'd like to think that we should do that. But the pandemic has further ravaged public mm-hmm. school system, and more people want out of public schools. So it is a moment of reckoning now. And unfortunately, I really don't think we've come to a full reckoning that we need to yet.
I should say, too, that Rahm Emanuel is going to be an ambassador to Japan. So not just a cushy job on ABC, but rewarded by the Biden administration for the job that he's done. And you're absolutely right. It's like asking somebody, like starving somebody and giving them maybe two saltine crackers every 3 days and then saying, okay, go run a marathon. And then being like, why are they not able to run the marathon? That's what we were asking them to do all along. So I want to, I guess, talk a bit more about the pandemic and your perception of how this has moved the conversation around school choice and vouchers and charter schools. Because a lot of the kids need to go back to school crowd seems to be fairly on the affluent side. And then you also have responses like, here in New York, Eric Adams, when running for office, said, oh, the pandemic showed that we could essentially have one teacher for every 300 kids, right? Like, there's the wheels are turning and the Bill Gates types, like, how can we streamline this and pair with Bloomberg or pair with Google and make it a technological achievement to cut costs and educate our kids in this, like, crystallized way? Like, there's a very scary road that this could go down.
Yeah, and we're already going down that path. And what's scary is that all the research prior to the pandemic, there's a lot of debate and research and interpretation about what we can do about the charter schools. The majority are still performing worse than traditional public schools overall, right? But what was clear from all the research was that online education, all day online education, is a failure. It doesn't work. It's not going to work. And then the pandemic hits, and now we see this as probably one of the most viable options in terms of public health and safety, right? So it's going against what the research says. Some online education can work in small doses after school and specialized classes, but not as a substitute for traditional face-to-face. But the pandemic has taken away that, right, or in many ways, ability to go to school all day. So we see policies flying in the face of this research about online instruction. But not only that, people are so unhappy with their local public school because it's become dangerous, it's become unsafe. At the same time, some people want to send their kids there because they have to go back to work now, right? So that our schools have become so contentious that it just makes it so much harder to run that marathon that you're referring to. You know, the two saltines are now one saltine because of the pandemic. So it's just exacerbated the problem. It's made it much worse. The perception of public school is dropping even further because of the pandemic. And some of this too, in the cities where we're fortunate enough to have teacher unions, right? Teacher unions are being bashed. Look at the city of Chicago. So it's become more and more demonized by parents because they're not getting what they want out of the public school. So what's convenient? School choice. Let's pull out, right? And one thing about Gates, literally opening the gates to business-minded reform. Let's run it like a business. Let's partner with other businesses. Let's put this in the private sector. All of these ideas are music to the ears of people who aren't getting what they want out of public schools. And these are largely white families who have the ability to pull out at any time they want. And we see them calling the shots more than the actual research.
You mentioned it's largely white families, but there are grassroots activism from non-white families that are advocating for charter schools or vouchers in a different way. A lot of this, what I would imagine, is just kind of the chain reaction due to the underfunding of our public schools, and like black families, like white families, want the best outcome for their child. And so with this perception of public schools, to me, it's not shocking that you have these like pockets of activism bubbling up from people who just want better outcomes for their individual child or children they know. Is that an accurate assessment of kind of what's happening, at least downstream from this?
Yeah, it is accurate to point out how black families and families of color are embracing school choice as a way to improve education for their families and communities. And that makes sense when you put it in a longer historical context, because, you know, black families and families of color have been denied education since prior to the Civil War and enslavement. They were literally denied an education. And then it was segregated, right? And when you segregate or deny people an entry to public schools, privatization of private schools is an option. So black families and educators have relied on private schools long before white families have, right? So that is, it's sort of a part of educational resistance to provide an education by any means necessary. So during the Jim Crow era, for instance, that was called building a private school or Rosenwald school. During the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power era, that's called a community controlled school, building a school and providing the best education you can because white educators aren't doing it. Now it's conflating the terms with school choice, right? But if a civil rights grassroots activist is demanding to run their own school and it happens to be called a charter school, that's very different than Bill Gates or someone practicing, you know, a Milton Friedman notion of running a school. That's very different. That's about for-profit. That's about creating partnerships with Google or something like that. It's very different than saying we need to control our own school for the survival of our community. Very different, same rhetoric, but very different purpose or rationale for school choice.
It's a great point. So you're talking a lot about Chicago. I know you're in Illinois. And basically, I think that what Emmanuel did was as close to what we've gotten in a major city, like a full experiment about school choice as seen by the Milton Friedman types. So like, can you make the case about what it would truly look like to have choice as a fully funded education platform, basically, that being the dominant and actual way that we funded education, just basically as a free market choice option? What would that look like? Because it seems like it would be a lot worse than what we saw in Chicago, and that was pretty bad.
Yeah, and Emmanuel has really taken a toll. And then let's not forget Arne Duncan, right, who President Obama brought with him to Washington to run schools. And Chicago was a case in point that this wasn't going to work. They're trying to get rid of teachers' unions or to take their authority in determining what education should look like in the classroom. So they're attacking unions, right, which we've seen played out across the nation. And also this idea, we see it in Chicago, but to a lesser extent, like New Orleans is a classic example. I look at the book, Memphis, Charleston, South Carolina. These are choice systems where everyone can put in a choice where they want to go. And we see what's happening. It's devastating. Privilege and wealth determine who gets to go in the best schools. Because school choice, like a business, you can only serve so many consumers or customers than you have the physical space for. Well, what happens? Who do you think gets into those schools? It's the people who apply first. It's the people who know people making the decisions. Sometimes like a magnet school, the best magnet schools in Charleston, South Carolina, you have to take a test to get into the magnet school. And now there's an industry around taking these tests to pass the tests. Well, who can afford to take these prep tests?
Right.
It's people with wealth, which in this country is traditionally white families. So the very system that the very notion that it's an equal system, that we all have an equal say, is flawed from the start because it requires money and it requires capital to take advantage of these supposed choices that we have. And again, we see not everyone has equal access to that capital to get on the equal footing that we need to make the best choices. And one other thing I'll say too, I interviewed a woman who from Japan studying chemistry at the University of Chicago, right? So English is a second language. She's studying chemistry at the University of Chicago. She said trying to figure out Chicago's school choice system was more difficult than any PhD course she took at the University of Chicago, that it was so taxing and trying to figure out the process to get into it. Just can tell you how difficult these choices are. Nothing like the equal sort of, oh, let's just go to like a supermarket. Let's just go pick whatever we want that's best for us. In practice, it's nothing like that.
I mean, I remember that movie vaguely, Waiting for Superman, was that the one? I mean,
Superman, yeah.
Yeah, that didn't seem like it was a fun choice situation, but I don't remember fully actually the movie, so perhaps I shouldn't say that that's a good role. Then I want to ask you about the flip side of that. What would it look like if all of this money was just put into a fully funded public system? I mean, how much would that simplify everything and improve outcomes?
Well, it would make a world of difference if we properly invested it. I'll say one, that's such a hard argument to make because the, you know, Friedman or Friedmanomics, right? This notion is that people will literally say, I've gotten into debates about this on more than one occasion, that the argument is we have enough money or we even have too much money, that too much money is going into the system and it's not efficient because it's not run like a business. So you have to fight this argument that we have enough money. And look at the anti-union rhetoric. A lot of people are saying we're spending too much on teacher salaries, but you ask any teacher in the United States, they're going to need better working conditions that requires greater investment. But what would it look like? It would improve substantially if we invested in those who are going to a public school, who are committed to public schools, who have a history and track record of working to improve public schools. We know the solutions. We've been studying this problem for hundreds of years. We know the families and activists who want to improve schools. It's not just throwing money at public schools. It's investing in those individuals who know the solutions, who are there every single day, every night during the summer. Let's invest in those people who have the solutions, as opposed to the Bill Gates, as opposed to the business owners who are going in and proposing charter schools, as opposed to those who, you know, have these sort of chain charter schools, right? Let's invest in those who are closest to the public schools because they know the solutions. And this investment would really pay off with those who actually know what's going on.
Well, yeah, and I think obviously there are a few disincentives for the people involved in this as a business, right? They want it to be as profitable as possible. I guess we could talk about some of the profit motives and how that bastardizes the entire notion of public education or education in general. And also how they bump up against teachers' unions. You've touched on that a bit, but like, I think that's really instrumental to understanding this dynamic. Like there is a deep resentment from a lot of these folks about teachers' unions, which is the undercurrent for many of these discussions, is it not?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's like across the United States, it's this underlying sort of point of tension that we have with teacher unions. And we've had that tension existing in this country since, you know, the origination of teacher unions, that we really see the rise in the late 1960s, 70s, and 1980s. Ronald Reagan made that a part of his platform, but even in no surprise, even before that, Milton Friedman was speaking out against teacher unions where they existed and unions in general, that this was going to infect the marketplace, that this is going to make an unequal marketplace. Chester Finn, for instance, conservative education reformers continually go back to teacher unions as the problem. They are the roadblocks. They're the impediments to quality public education reform. Speaking of Waiting for Superman, Michelle Rhee was profiled as the solution to guiding reform. And her, you know, she of course was attacking teacher unions that they were getting in the way of reform. Mm. This school choice, right, and teacher unions have spoken out against it loudly and backed by research, right, are being demonized, right? So it's part of being pro-school choice, is being anti-union as well. And, you know, ironically enough, and this is sort of the caveat on history, and I have a piece coming on this too, Al Shanker and the teacher unions were the first to propose charter schools, because they envisioned teacher-led charter schools for up to 5 years to find solutions at work and then go back to the public school system. It was a way to give actually teachers more power. But the way history played out, they wrote teachers and teacher unions out of that to take power away. It's much easier and it's more efficient in terms of the cost to hire, right, a Teach for America graduate, if you will, or Teach for America teacher, than it is to hire a fully credentialed, well-educated professional teacher. It's just much more efficient. You mentioned talk about, oh, we now learn that we can have one teacher for 50 plus students, much more efficient according to the marketplace. But get rid of the unions in order to make that happen. So you're exactly right. There's this underlying anti-union sentiment that supports school choice.
So you mentioned that, you know, charter school outcomes are on average worse. I guess to lastly, to wrap things up, talk about those outcomes and what's been found thus far.
Well, it's how you interpret the data. And I talk about this in the book. I mean, you can look at numbers, and Bill Gates was touting some of this research that said 40% of charter school students are doing better than public school students in math. And the numbers show 40, even upwards of 44%, which, considering that charter schools started, we really started them in, you know, 30 years ago this year, that's pretty, in one way, that's pretty good. You know, 44% are doing well. But let's reverse that number, right? 56% of your students going to a charter school are not being served by your charter school, and they would be better off going to a traditional public school, right? Or look at other numbers, which show that the numbers of charter schools that are closing in particular in cities in the middle of a school year because they ran out of funding or they're accused of fraud. We lose these individual stories of what it's like to go to a failing charter school when we focus on that 40% number. We lose what it means to go to a failing school or a private school that has, you know, has every right to close up shop whenever they want to and send you off to a different school. Those narratives and those stories are so profound. Public school has to accept everybody who comes to its public doors, no matter what. They will always be there. It's not necessarily the same for a charter school. So yes, the majority of students are still being better served by a traditional public school, as problematic or as much of a struggle it can be. They're still being better served by a traditional system that has been here for hundreds of years, right? They will better serve the public than any privatized notion of education. No doubt about it.
John Hale, author of The Choice We Face, The Origins of School Choice and the Demise of Public Education. Thanks so much for your time, John, today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and be back in a second. We are back. Thanks, everybody, for continuing to tune in. We've got a little bit more of a show for you today, so off to Fox News we go. We've got a new fixation, folks. It's not a tan suit this time. It's not a coffee cup salute. Not even the crime of mustard on a burger. It's a nervous laugh. Kamala Harris's nervous laugh, and the curious case of the timing of that laugh. And does that even make her a patriot? Does she love America because of the timing of this laugh? You'll have to see what the people over at Fox News have to say about it.
Hey, Sandra, let's now bring in Washington Times opinion editor and Fox News contributor Charlie Hurt to talk more about this. And Charlie, I wanted to start off with this piece of video that we've been running all day today of Kamala Harris being asked on her Asia trip about Afghanistan, where she seems to laugh off the question from a reporter. Listen here.
Hey, listen. So I'm going to... Well, hold on. Slow down, everybody. I want to talk about two things. First, Afghanistan. We couldn't have a higher priority right now.
Okay,
so Charlie, I don't know if that's just a nervous tick.
Just like, okay, so I watch this and I think, okay, the laugh must be coming later, right? The question that she laughed off and it was so outrageous, she's walking up as a plane is blaring and she starts laughing, saying, wait, hold on one second, I'm going to make an opening statement. Yes, her laugh is a little weird. It's a tick. I don't care. But like...
Well, I'll just say it's a liability, like her nervous laughter. And it's fabricated here, but it was evident during the primary that she laughs when she's nervous. And I just think, like, if you're going to be, say, possible president in the future and you need to say, Kamala, there's news that a hospital in Iran has some weird sabotage issues. We need you to go out and deny that we had any part of it. And she breaks out in a big grin. It's going to be a problem. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. So, like, it is. Sure, it's going to be this kind of liability in terms of like, oh, Hillary's so annoying and look at her laugh and we're going to make this back-to-back montage of it. And I'm sure right-wing media is going to obsess about it. But like the idea that they're genuinely concerned about her response to Afghanistan, they actually are genuinely think she's laughing off the risks that Americans are facing in Afghanistan. Like, oh, my Lord. But we'll continue. Let's hear the unhinged commentary.
On her part, or if it's a way of her taking a beat to gather her thoughts, but it just seems so misplaced, particularly in this case, when, as Sandra was pointing out, we had that story of the mother who dropped a 2-year-old child in the rush to get to the airport gates, and the child was trampled to death under the feet of so many hundreds of people who were rushing the gates as well.
Well, precisely, John. I mean, you know, I think that you're probably right that it is sort of an effort to sort of gather her thoughts. And after all, she was being asked specifically about Afghanistan when she shushed the reporter and said, hold on a second, and then begins to talk about Afghanistan and answer the question. But it really is. It does reveal a terrible sense of politics, a terrible sense of the seriousness of the situation that the country is concerned about right now in Afghanistan. And
it is so funny to do that instead of reporting.
I know. Well, okay, so they mentioned the child that tragically died in Afghanistan, right? If the reporter had asked her about the death of a child and she started laughing, okay, maybe you'd have a case. But like, it's interesting that they're going down this road. It seems like Kamala Harris, given the fact that we know that she is a pretty fake politician and does not come off well, in my view, and if she chooses to run for president in 2024, she's going to run into some issues because of that. But regardless, like, the fact that this is what they're focusing on is interesting. It's of course laced with misogyny. It's of course laced with racism, and it's like no surprise that they're doing these same kinds of Obama type attacks about like very small aspects of the way she conducts herself in relation to national security. Oh, he's saluted with the coffee cup. That means he loves the Taliban. Like, that they're doing this with her. And not even necessarily with Biden. Yeah, they're trying to say Biden is beholden to the far left and he's falling apart and he can't remember anything. There is a specificity for this kind of attack that they're reserving for Kamala Harris. And unfortunately, I think it's going to catch on. But part of that is her fault because she is a fake politician. Regardless, doesn't get more ridiculous than this. All right, folks, that's our time for today. We will see you tomorrow. But we're still here. We're still here for the non-Peacock audience.
Indeed.
Oh,
and look who else is here.
Nomi?
There she is.
Whoa. I don't see her yet.
She's making her way through
the Zoom obstacle sort of
tubes
course
at this point right now.
Right. The tubes. Aluminum tubes. Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
How
goes
it today? Hi.
But Sam's on screen. I'm so confused. What's the deal?
Well, he's not on screen. We're just wiring my audio through his computer.
Got it. That's back end stuff. That's insider talk for everybody. I know you're jealous, but
there you go.
I got the ins.
Yeah, it's just virtual Sam is part of our infrastructure at this point.
Might be better than real life Sam, maybe.
I mean, he's a lot easier to deal with, I'll be honest.
Right. He doesn't say too much. The other Sam does seem to talk a lot. But
very stressed out either.
Yeah, this fake computer Sam doesn't seem to get that angry about tech issues, although I can't even speak because we had tech issues on Friday and I was in a cold sweat for like 3 hours just in like quiet rage about it, and no one did anything wrong. It's just like the camera malfunctioned. I know you know the pain, Nomi.
Oh, I do. I was like 5 minutes before this, I was like fighting with the Wi-Fi gods. I'm like, why are you doing this to me? Just when you think you have it right, there's always something. There's something.
Right. Yes. Always something. What is happening over on the Nomiki show?
I don't know. We're filming from Greece. We're just doing the show. No. We have...
No, you have a very special guest you can't tell us about tomorrow. That's how you frame it.
No, we have, I mean, as everybody knows, we've been doing a lot of international stuff since I've been in Greece. And actually, I want to do a little plug because we are going to post something special. I think today is the day we're posting. Today's Tuesday. Yeah. And it is an interview we did with with Arun Chowdhury, who has the committee program on Mondays on our channel, and he does international work, and he was the creative director for Bernie Sanders, and also my dear friend Dimitri, who is a former advisor to the prime minister here in Greece, and he talks about just sort of like where the left is going in Europe and how leftist movements, obviously it's very different per country, but it's a special. It's really fascinating conversation. We taped it actually a little while ago, but it's probably even more relevant right now. So go to youtube.com/TheNomiKisha. Go check it out. You're not going to get that anywhere else. I got to tell you, I think what's unique to our little situation is most of the people we bring on have like done the work on the ground, and a lot of us have done the work on the ground in these different places. I see these memes go up being like, oh, you guys are all just talking heads. Like, what are you talking about? We've actually done the organizing on the ground, and we're talking heads. That's a lot of work. So
there you go.
If you want to see it, go check it out.
Double the fun. Matt, what's happening over on Lek Reckoning, right? That's what it's called?
No, Left Reckoning tomorrow night. We have Chip Gibbons, a journalist focused on civil liberties, talking about a couple things, Assange, Daniel Hale, and we play an old Nixon tape from the morning Nixon found out about the Pentagon Papers. And we also talk about how to deal with this weird era we're in, where the left is always and even now concerned about right-wing collaboration with law enforcement, but also when law enforcement is using right-wing extremism as a sort of way to pad their budgets. How do we walk that line and react to what we're seeing, particularly with violence on the streets stoked on by a major political party? So that tomorrow night, Wednesday, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game. And go subscribe to the YouTube, folks.
Do that. And I guess we'll just head into the fun half. We'll take some calls. We'll have some fun in the fun half, such as the name. 646-257-3920. See you guys there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Bye.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break time.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Blast. Come on. Blast. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.